Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the max level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. When you keep an open mind, you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. You'll also see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now tonight, my guest is Stephen Schwartley. He's a first-time fiction writer. He suffered a major stroke in 2013, and that's when his creativity blossomed, and he started writing the book he had in his head since his college days. His quirky sense of humor permeates his life. He lives in Cave Creek, Arizona, with his wife, Joy, and two Yorkies, Jack and Foxy, and a rescue dog, too. What's the name of the rescue dog, Steve?
Wally.
Wally. Well, now, which was the one that was sick last night?
The one that was sick last night was Jack, and we're not sure what was going on, but he looked like he was at death doorstop last night.
Oh, my. Well, let's backtrack in time and find out how you felt when you had that stroke. Was that a taste of death's doorstep to you?
Well, I'll tell you what. It was a two-day process, I think, leading up to the stroke. But, I was working for an individual that I wasn't quite pleased with. And so one day I decided to go out and play golf on a Friday afternoon. And what happened was I was playing golf on a Friday afternoon. It was 112 degrees. And the person that usually runs around with a golf cart with full of beer and sodas and other things decided it was too hot, so she left. So basically at the end of the day, I ran out of something to drink and got dehydrated, so I think I got kind of a heat stroke. And then on Saturday, I just felt tired all day, and then Saturday night went to see a movie, and on the way home, I was driving with my wife and some friends, and man, I just felt disoriented. And then Sunday morning, the day of the stroke, some of my friends came over and watched NASCAR. So I must admit, I am a redneck. So we were watching NASCAR, and I was on the couch, and I was so tired, even though I slept all night, I couldn't keep my eyes open. And then about 1 o'clock when the race was over, my wife and I went out and jumped out in the pool. Once again, it was 112 or 13 degrees. And about a half hour later, she said, I'm hungry. Let's do a barbecue. So when I got out of the pool and reached for the towel, I stood up, and I also stood up, and I went completely back over, landed on my back on my recliners, and that was the beginning of the stroke. So it was just kind of eerie. I can't really define when it really happened, but by the time I got into the house to take a look, see what happened, because I just felt kind of dizzy, I looked into the mirror and remember the old actor Marty Feldman that was on Young Frankenstein?
Oh, yes. Yes.
You remember how he had one funky eye off to the side?
Yes.
What I had that day. So, my eye was off, and I'm just going, oh, my gosh. And so I knew I had a stroke when I looked in the mirror. So my wife took me to the hospital. So if I could say one thing to your listeners, one thing you should always remember is if you have an opportunity to go to your doctor and say, hey, if I have a stroke or a heart attack, which hospital should I go to? If you have a multitude of hospitals around the area, because the day of the stroke, I found out I went to one of the hospitals where you just go to die.
Oh, wow.
They didn't even have a neurology department. So, I didn't know there was good and bad hospitals, but I do now. So.
Yeah. Well, I am aware of those things locally, and as you say, it can make a difference. It sounds like you're a miracle to be alive.
Well, the doctor that worked on me down in the emergency room, he came up on Monday, say about 11 o'clock in the morning, and it was just after my wife, who came back to the hospital to visit me, had taken off to go do an appointment. He comes in the room and he goes, "Hey, you know, and I know you had a stroke, but I got to release you because the hospital can't find the stroke." And I go, "What?" He goes, "Here's my business card, and here's a neurologist on the back with the phone number, and I've already set up an appointment with you on Wednesday for him to take a look at you. He's one of the top 10 in the state, and go see him. But if you have a problem, once I have to release you, don't come back here."
Oh, my God.
That was pretty eye-opening. And then, you know, how they usually wheelchair you out of a hospital after you've been admitted. I just walked out. They didn't even, you know, give me a chair or anything. So, but the funny thing was, Wednesday, when I went to see this guy, my old boss, my wife, drove me there because they wanted to make sure I answered all the questions instead of fudging something. And the neurologist says, "Oh, yeah, you know, here's the deal. You'd be amazed how many times I have to tell the technicians that read the scans, you know, from people like you, where the problem is, because they miss them." And
wow.
So when he read the scans, he goes, "Yep, here it is right there." And I'm just going, "Oh, my God." You know, so I was lucky.
Yeah, I'd say so. Well, so how did it change your life?
Well, about 4 months afterwards, the company I was working for laid me off. And so at that time of my life, I was 63 years of age, now unemployed. All the people that I sent applications to for employment, you know, with my resume, just weren't interested in somebody being with a stroke and 63. So my wife, who is a psychologist, says, "You know, hey, now's the time to start writing those books." So starting about November, you know, almost 2 years ago now, I went up to my bedroom office, which I now affectionately refer to as the cage, and I started to write the book. You know, I treated it like a job, 8 hours a day or 10 hours a day, and 4 months later, I had the book done.
Well, we're talking about the book Enemy in the Heartland. Would you tell the listeners a little bit about the story?
Sure, not a problem. The story... Well, let me say it this way. The book is based on the premise of 6 degrees of separation, which you're aware of that.
Yeah.
You know, somebody somewhere knows everybody. So, and
then
the other one is fate. You know, if you would have gone left or right, what would have happened? You know, so the story starts out with a mullah over in the Middle East. I mean, he runs into an old grade school friend of his, and now they're both in their 60s, and this friend's got a grandson who is wealthy, and he is kind of going off to the dark side, and the grandfather is, you know, worried about it. And he says, "Hey, can you check around with your friends?" Because he knew the guy was connected, the mother was connected, and see what my son's into, grandson's into. So the mullah gave the picture to, believe it or not, a Mossad agent that he knew that lived in the neighborhood, without giving away too much of the story. And a couple weeks later, the Mossad agent was in a big intelligence meeting with a bunch of other intelligence agencies around the world. And during the break one day, the guy had the kid's picture up, and the guy sitting beside him was from New York. And he goes, "Hey, your picture looks like my picture, except for he's a little older." And they ran a little facial recognition on both photos, and they realized this is the same guy who just got done blowing up a building in New York City. And that's where the chase begins. That's where the chase begins. And there's a secret organization I call the Olympia Committee, and it's based off of, remember the Olympics in around 1972 in Germany when the athletes got shot?
Yes,
well,
I do.
I used the premise of, okay, you know, big countries, you don't see wars really anymore, but the big hot spot is terrorism, you know. And so these countries formed this organization after the Olympics back in 72 called the Olympia Committee. It's kind of like Interpol, but more secret. And these big countries get together to track down terrorism stuff, you know, which is not as easy as it sounds. And, you know, this terrorist outfit is coming to the United States, and this Olympia Committee has wind of them now, and they're trying to chase them down. So that's the book. And the terrorists, their target is central United States, because let me ask you a question, Dave. If you were going to go after a target to really scare the psyche of a country, would you go after a hard target or something easy and soft?
I think I'd go after something easy and soft.
You're a good man, because it sounds like you've read my book. So, yeah, because what the book entails is the terrorists have plotted for 13 years. They're well-funded. They've got lots of money, and they steal drones, and somehow they get some poison gas, and they're going to go up and down the central United States with drones, going after kids and mommies and daddies at Little League baseball games and, you know, county fairs and stuff to really scare the hell out of the United States.
Well, from the reviews that you've gotten, it sounds like you managed to do that to a lot of your readers as well. Steve has garnered a lot of five-star reviews on Amazon.com, where the book is available. Where else can people find the book?
I do have a website. The website is Stephen with a P-H, so it's S-T-E-P-H-E-N, Swertley, S-C-H-W-E-R, T's and Tom, L-E-Y, author.com. I know it's a long one, but if you go there, you can get the printed copy or an autographed copy there. But Amazon sells 85% of the books and ebooks in the world, which is scary. So I've just put it on there just because I'm lazy.
Yeah, well, I don't blame you. That's where I take my books too. Just curious, how did you decide to go with the premise of the 6 degrees of separation? And then I'm very intrigued by the concept of if you made a right turn or a left turn, how the decision tree would work out.
Well, it's, you know, I've traveled all my life. I used to travel 40 to 45 weeks a year, being either regional or national or international sales manager through my life, and I've sold everything from robots to wheel balancers, so I've seen just about everything. But, you know, I'm always amazed at running into somebody somewhere that knows one of my friends on the other side of the world. And So one day, Joy was talking to one of her friends, and lo and behold, this person knew this person, and it turns out she was looking for a friend of hers, and they're going, oh, he's over here in Poland. He was in the military. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it happens all the time, just craziest circumstances, you know, where people pop up after you've not seen them for like 30 years.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's an amazing idea that if you know a person who knows six people and so on and so forth, that you could know everybody in the world. What made you decide to go into writing? When did the bug begin? Did you have aspirations to write a book when you were younger?
No, my parents, who are long passed away, they're probably rolling in the grave, because when I went to grade school and high school, I mean, I struggled to get a C in English, and during the years after I got out of college, I've got a biology degree. I wanted to be a doctor, but I just didn't keep the grades up. I was tending bar when I was going to college and played more than studied, so it shows. But I just didn't have any inkling to write. You know, the closest thing I did to writing was either marketing plans or sales reports for the companies I worked for. But, you know, when you're sitting around after a stroke and you don't have a lot of energy, and, you know, you try to walk a couple miles around the block to build your energy up, you get bored. And the neurologist says, hey, you know, now that you're recovering, you need to find something to stimulate your mind, you know, something that, you know, to think, to get organized. Because after I had the stroke, finally about 2 weeks later, my eyes snapped directly forward, from the Marty Feldman thing. But my speech was really impaired, and I figure, if you didn't know me, it was noticeable, but, you wouldn't know how bad it was. I figured I lost about 20% of my speech process, putting things together. And right now I think I'm about 95% back together, and I think that's all because when you write, you've got to have some rhythm, an orderly process. I mean, when I write a book, I do an outline and a recap in my book, as I type and go, so I can keep, the storyline straight and all the characters and things that I want to put in the book in the book. So, I think the book really helped me recover. And the book's turned out to be kind of fun. And I've already finished the second book, which should be released in the next week to 10 days. The person that's formatting the book into ebooks and the printed copy, she had an operation, so I kind of slowed her down. But the cover is done and everything. And it's called Revenge Unleashed. And I've already started on the third book, which I'm switching topics a little bit because I'm taking drones out of the picture. I figured that for once, before I die, I use my biological degree. So the third book is called Homegrown, The Unexpected Terror, which you see homegrowns on the news all the time, plus drones. But the Homegrown book is going to be about a biological attack on the U.S.
Mm. Wow.
So I guess I am kind of sick and warped after the stroke.
Well, it sounds like you've been pretty prolific. Three books, working on your third book within 2 years. That's great. How long does it take to write a
book? How long does it take to write the book? The first book took me 4 months, but nobody told me the easiest part of getting a book is the writing. It's the marketing, mm-hmm. and getting the book from your laptop to the bookshelf. That's the hard part. For the first book, it took me 9 months. I mean, I had to go find an editor, and then I had to go find a proofreader. I had to go find, a cover designer. I had to find my shepherd to format and keep me all honest and everything. And once that was in place, the second book took maybe 5 months to write. But what slowed that one down getting it to the marketplace, because I was hoping to have it out about a month ago, was I have to do social media now to market my book to find talk show hosts like you to promote the book, because that's the other side of the equation. Since I'm an independent author, I don't have a big publishing house behind me. I got to go out and find talk shows, and, by the graces of good people like you, they let me on the air and talk about my book so I can sell 4 or 5 books a day.
Right, right. It's not easy, folks. I can certainly relate to that. I have yet to have a book published with a major publisher, and when you're dealing with an independent publisher, they don't have the marketing arm that a big publisher has, and so 99% of the effort falls on the author, and that's a huge challenge.
Well, one of the things I did right after I got done with the first book is I live on the north side of Phoenix, and just north of me is a town called Cave Creek, and they've got the best library in the state called Desert Foothills Library, and they have, believe it or not, the author forum once a month, and I heard about it because one of my neighbors writes spiritual books, and so I went up there one day and was talking to the lady at the library, and she says, "Oh yeah, you wrote a book." I said, "Yeah, here, let me give you one." So I gave her a copy of it and went into this meeting, and then the next month when I went back, she was sitting there at the front door waiting for me, and she said, "Oh good, I'm glad you're here." I said, "Why?" She says, "Will you sign this book?" So yeah, why? She said, "This is really good, and I'd like to help you. What can I do to help you?" And it was one of the best things that ever happened to me, because I said, I want to meet one or two or three best-selling authors. I don't care what they write. They have to be best-selling authors in the Phoenix area so I can go see them and meet them and kind of get some mentoring, because there are no classes on how to promote a book or even to write a book. So I've been very, very fortunate. There's an Alan Black, who writes all kinds of different types of stories. In fact, he is, I think, the fifth on the sci-fi readers list or bestsellers list this month for his Metal Boxes. And there's a Barbara Hensky, who's a title attorney, but she writes love stories. You know, and she's written 8 or 9 love stories, and you know, both these people are making really big bucks. And the biggest thing they told me to do is be patient, don't starve to death, but you need to write 3 books to really grab traction, and then beg for as many reviews as you can.
Well, it's mind-boggling to me, the whole process, and I was just thinking about my own process with regards to getting books out there and marketing them, and it can be a little bit overwhelming.
Yeah, I say if you're going to try to do it on your own, you know, good luck. And you know, so far, you know, I haven't made the top sellers list, but I really encourage anybody to try to find some, you know, good selling authors around your neighborhood and team up with them and pick their mind, because they've been where I've been, you know, just starting out and everything. So it's kind of like an apprenticeship journeyman, you know, exercise almost. But you know, if you're lucky enough to have some of those people around, reach out, touch them, because most of them are more than happy to, you know, give you some time out of their day. I mean, you can't pester them and sit on their doorstep, but you know, they'll converse with you and everything. And I'll get together with one or two of them, you know, like once a month. But it's been one of the best good fortunes, you know, that have happened to me to get this book going. So, because it does get kind of depressing. You're sitting there working 8-10 hours a day and you're only making like $1 a day or something, you know, trying to get the book sold. So that's why I spend probably 2 to 3 hours a day just doing social media marketing on LinkedIn and Twitter and then Facebook.
Uh-huh. Well, what other suggestions did they have for you?
The biggest thing is, you know, don't use too many exclamation points. I mean, put it this way, you ever see those word games where you'll see them on Facebook or somewhere? The words are misspelled and everything, and they say, if you can read this, you're in the top 15 or 20% of the people. They're kind of like word puzzles. Yeah, and it's all misspelled and everything, but, you know, your mind, if you're doing a lot of reading, can get by the mistakes and you can actually read that stuff. And
yeah,
a lot of people can't, but those who can, and I'm unfortunately one of those who can, you know, it turned out to be a detriment, because when I was reading my book, you know, before I gave it to my editor, I didn't see the mistakes because I just read right through it. Plus, after reading it about 3 times, you get kind of bored reading the same story. So, you know, there's a place called, I forgot the name of the website. But there is a website where you can find editors. And so I found a couple editors right around my neighborhood here in Phoenix. But it was funny, after sending him the first 2 chapters of the book and say, hey, here's my book, would you be interested in editing him? It was amazing of the reaction of a lot of people that said no. And I mean, it was funny. One of the reactions was, well, this book is over, you know, 200 pages. I don't want to touch it. I'm going, well, I'm going to pay you. And probably half the people said that, which kind of blew me away. And some didn't like the subject matter. And a couple people wrote back, oh, gee, wonderful, wonderful book. I'd love to do this book. I'm going, I don't know. But I was fortunate enough. Oh, the name of the website was Thumbtack. But I was fortunate enough to find a guy who retired from Boeing Helicopter here in Mesa, Arizona, which is the other side of Phoenix from me. And he was the PR director for the helicopter company. I'm going, gee, that's kind of cool. And he wrote back, and his first comment was, hey, you and I need to talk. So I called him up, and I said, well, how do you like your book? He said, well, it's going to be a lot of work to edit. And I said, really? He said, yeah. How accurate do you want the book to be? And I said, well, you know, wanted the military people to read it, you know, the Tom Clancy or the Clyde Plesser fans, the Dale Brown fans to enjoy the book. He said, well, you got a mistaken list of characters. I go, what? I didn't even meet the, you know, get past the prologue of the first chapter. He said, oh, no. I said, well, what's the problem? Well, he says you got a problem with one of the people that you're that are flying in one of your Apache helicopter gunships. And I said, well, what's the problem? He says, you've got a sergeant inside one of those helicopter gunships, and that can't be. And I said, why? And this was before he told me he was, you know, from Boeing helicopter. And he says, nobody underneath the rank of chief warrant officer is allowed to get in there. And then he told me it was from Boeing, and I'm going, you and I need to meet. And so he edited my first book, and he edited the second book, and he'll be doing the third one. And then the other thing I think if people are serious about writing is once you get the book done, give it out to two or three people before you go to the expense of printing it to see what they think of it. You know, see if they think that you're missing something or whatever. And one of my wife's friends is a lieutenant colonel in NATO, and he's in intelligence, and we sent him the book. And, you know, after about a month, he wrote back. He said, hey, you need to promote some of these people in your book so they can do what you say they're going to be doing in the book. But he said, were you ever in the military, the CIA, or the FBI? Because if you're not, you might get a phone call because this is damn scary and too realistic. So I'm going,
oh, wow.
Yeah, So I did it. But the funny thing is this, what would you think somebody when they come up and go, and this has happened in a lot of interviews, is this a fiction book? I'm going, well, I hope so, because there's a lot of dead people. There wasn't. But, I mean, I think that's one of the funniest questions I get all the time. Is this fiction? I'm going, are you from space?
Well, that's quite a compliment.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, the funny thing, you were talking about reviews on Amazon. If you go back and look at the list of reviews, the funniest thing to me is about three-quarters or, you know, 70% of the reviews are written by women. And I had no idea women would be attracted to the book, and I really didn't target them, but they're the majority of the reviews. So I don't know if they read more, they're more intelligent, or they just like to get feedback. I have no idea, but, you know, it was quite funny if you read the reviews from some of these ladies, because they wrote like a page and a half reviews on Amazon for them, which I'm going, ka-ching.
Yeah, that's great. Wow. What kind of advice would you give to somebody that wants to write a novel based on your own experience?
Well, I'd say probably, you know, when you get ideas, you know, get yourself a notebook, a three-ring notebook, and put a bunch of paper in there. And when you get ideas, kind of write them down in sequence. Like what I do is I write chapter one, chapter two, chapter three, you know, so every page, you know, front and back is one chapter. And I'll put ideas in chapter two or five or 15, whenever I get the ideas, because when I get to that part of the book when I'm writing, I'll just take a pencil and I'll just put a line through them saying, okay, I've included that idea. But I think it's really important to write a recap at the other end of the book. I got to divide in my three-ring notebook. And what I do is I'll put down page number 1 or page number 38 or page number 147, you know, where the subheading is, and write what those subheadings, you know, what's underneath those subheadings, just to keep track of everything. Because I'll tell you what, once you get up to about 180,000 words, you get confused real easy. Did I do that? You know, and then you go back and read something on page 25 and go, God, that felt like a long time ago since I wrote that.
Well, you know, the other thing that I found to be a real challenge, and certainly had been warned in advance that that would be the case, is trying to find a literary agent to get interested in a book. What was your process like with regards to that?
Well, put it this way. I haven't, you know, it's funny. Most of the get people I've talked to, my best-selling authors, they are, let me close something out here, website here, because I'm going to go grab something here as we talk, because I just found something the other day for literary agents. But, you know, the people I know, they're best-selling authors, they don't have an agent. And lo and behold, the other day, there was a TV article here on one of the TV stations talking about how she went from writing a book, and she's a millionaire now, and I think she's in her late 20s. I mean, very attractive lady. Her name is April Lynn, and she writes a bunch of different types of books. And so I wrote to her, and she said, hey, I don't really talk to the phone, but here's where I'd go. And she sent me an email list all about 2 days ago, which I haven't had a chance to go through. I just pulled it up here on the screen there. And if everybody's got a pencil, just write down www.agentquery.com. Agentquery.com. And it's like, you know, writers, agents, publishing resources, e-publishing network and stuff. So it's kind of like a cheat sheet of where to kind of go to find somebody like you and I are looking for all the time.
Do you think that you'll try that approach with the next book?
I don't know. What I've been doing is when I go on LinkedIn, you know, I've been putting in inquiries like talk show host, TV talk show host, da da da. But also what I've been doing is producers and directors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's been kind of interesting doing this social media exercise, as I call it, because I'll send out, say if I send out 100 invitations to connect, about, I'd say half of them respond. And out of those 50 that I send out, for every 17 that I send out, my custom cut and paste, you know, form letter saying, hey, I'm looking for interviews, or I'm looking for this, or looking for that, I get a response about one out of every 17, which doesn't sound like very good, but direct mail is 3% return, and I'm getting about 12 or 13% return. So I get right now, since I started to look for, you know, talk show hosts and movie director stuff, I get contacts probably where I do an interview twice a week, sometimes three times a week now, and I'm picking up a interested person who is a director or a movie producer. Not that they give any commitments, but they'll say, hey, where can I get the book? So, you know, without a problem, I send them an autographed copy and say, hey, I'll be in touch. So, you know, right now I'm at the tip of the iceberg, and it's going to be interesting to see where all this goes. But, you know, being retired and nobody wants to hire somebody, it's not too intelligent anymore. I guess I have to do this for a living.
Well, there could be worse things to do for a living, and it sounds like it could be the road that lead to a lot of excitement for you, too. You know,
well,
imagine
you know,
having to be made out of your own book. What could be better than that?
After the stroke, I got to thank my lucky stars, because I could have been paralyzed and an invalid all my life. So, and I figured, you know, I survived for some reason. So I figured I'll use the rest of my time to try to make a difference. And, I got into the writing part after I started to enjoy it. And it was kind of like an investment, you know, kind of like a monthly in check, you know, so that I'll have this check coming in for the rest of my life. So all I have to do is keep increasing the digits from $5 to $10 to $100, $1,000, you know. So there's no telling where this is going to go. So it's been kind of a fun ride. And, you know, who knows?
Well, that's just it. And I my personal belief is that, you know, you need to start somewhere, and from there you need to have a dream, and you need to believe in yourself, and you need to not give up, and it sounds like you're leaving no stone unturned. How important is that to you in your life?
Well, put it this way. After the first book, and I got probably three-quarters of the way through the third book, which is back in about April of this year. And, you know, I was getting kind of depressed because I'm going, man, you know, all of a sudden, you know, Christmas is over and nobody's buying books anymore. And, you know, is this crazy? Am I fooling myself? And, you know, the other authors that I have run into and made connections with, a couple of people that have a bookstore, they said, no, you don't get it. You got to keep doing this. It will pay, you know. You got to play it forward. So, you know, so I guess it's either, you know, what do they say, you know, jump in with both hands or both feet or whatever, or here we come, you know, bonsai. So, you know, I'm going for it because I'd like to leave something behind, because do you ever think about once you die, how long will it be before, you know, the planet forgets you? In like 10 years, will anybody remember your name? So I'd like
right.
to leave something back there, you know, that, you know, 100 years from now, hey, this guy was kind of a kook, you know, picking up an old book and stuff. So
I love it.
You know, so, you know, it keeps me off the streets, and every once in a while my wife will kick me out of the office because she says, you've been in here too long, go play golf or something, you know, because, you know, you do have to have a break because your mind just goes goofy. It's not writer's block. It's just, you know, you just get so involved that all of a sudden you're going 18 million ways and not getting anything done, it seems like.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the publishing process. How did you approach that?
Well, when I first, you know, finished writing the book, or towards the end of finishing the first book, you know, I looked up on the internet and Googled, you know, publishers and stuff, and, you know, start sending off some chapters, and just never heard back from anybody. And I probably sent out, I don't know, 50 or 60 of them, and just never heard back from anybody. And, you know, even on LinkedIn, when I went to publishers, you know, I've only had probably out of, well, maybe 100 inquirers, one lady coming back that was even close to a publisher. She was an agent. And when she found out that I didn't sell more than 10,000 books, you know, yet, she just never, you know, replied back to any of my emails again. So that still is a mystery to me. I have not broken that glass ceiling, you know, but I'm planning to. But, you know, a friend of mine who is a transportation coordinator for movies has kind of sat down with me. You know, he's a college friend. I mean, we've known each other for 4 years, and he says, hey, dude, you've written good stuff. It's going to take a while, because he was telling me, even for the movies he works on, and he's worked on, like, you know, what is it, Stargate, and what was the Johnny Depp movie, The Lone Ranger? I mean, he's been on all these big movies. He says these things are like a 5 to 8 year project sometimes to get these from book to script to the big screen. And that's just the 1% to do make it, you know. So he says, you got to remember one thing, you're competing against 5,000 new books that are being published every day, which is a crazy number.
Now, you published this book yourself.
Yeah, I'm an indie.
Yeah.
They call it an independent publisher. But, you know, what I would do if I was in, you know, Cleveland or Sioux Falls, South Dakota, or some small town, find somebody that's in that niche, you know, that helps authors get published. There, I work with a lady by the name of Vicki Mons, and she's helped me, you know, get the book together and find a cover designer and stuff. And I think the cover design is one thing that we should talk about later, because it makes a big difference on a book. But she's kind of been my shepherd. But even, you know, with her contacts, it's hard to get the big guys to look at it, because they want to repeat bestsellers. And that's what, you know, that's where they make their fat cat money.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to break the niche, but once they see you do 2 or 3 books and you're starting to get reviews, and, you know, and it's the reviews that really help push your book. It's not so much the numbers of what people really think about the book, and if they're willing to write reviews, and I beg people all the time when they get my book, please write a review. I'll love you forever. But those are the things that people look for from the big publishing houses. So, you know, I just, probably for every 2 books I sell, I send out a freebie to a talk show host or a movie director or whatever I find out there that's, you know, interested. So,
well, let's talk a little bit about the cover design. Where did you go to get help with that? And it's a very compelling cover. I love it.
Well, my wife is from South Africa, and we met online about 15 years ago. And one of her best friends is still living in South Africa. His name is Ludwig. And Ludwig and I have become brothers by the use of Skype. We talk on Skype, you know, face-to-face, you know, probably once or twice a week over the last couple of years. And, you know, I got him to kind of like read the book, and he's kind of played with the editing a little bit. But now I forgot where we were going with this question. That's what happened.
Oh, we were talking about the cover design.
Oh, cover design. So when I got close to the end of the book, Enemy in the Heartland, I was going, you know, I'm not sure what I want for a cover design, but I had my daily planner in front of me. I said, you know, I can picture the outline of the United States and maybe the flag draped down on it. And since the book uses drones, I put little airplanes on there, you know, stick figures kind of. And, you know, we start talking about the book. So when I got done talking with him that day, well, I have, although in my in my daily planner, I had about 85% of the concept done for the book. And then when I met the cover designer, and this guy is a real pro, and he does a lot of, you know, scientific magazine covers and stuff, and his name is Dennis McLean. You know, we sat around and talked, and, you know, so the first ideas, you know, because I didn't tell him what I had in mind. I just said, hey, this is what the book is. So he came back with a couple of renditions, and I'm going, now you're close, but not close. And that cover took like 7 renditions before he really, really nailed it. But my feeling is, if you don't have a cover, it has to grab, put it this way, a cover has to grab somebody's attention as they're walking by a bookstand within 3 seconds. Because if they don't like the cover, they're not going to pick it up. It's kind of like a car. If you don't like the looks of the car, you're probably not going to get inside and give it a test drive. So,
exactly.
I spent a lot of time. It took about 2.5 months to get that cover done because I was not his only client. So, you know, I was on the bottom of the totem pole, you know, trying to get time. But, you know, the more you communicate with your cover designer, the better it's going to be. But it's got to be something eye-popping to make it look different. And so we just got done doing the second cover. And the second cover took about 2 weeks. You know, not that he worked on it for 2 weeks. He probably worked on it for about an hour. But the second cover, we wanted it to blend in with the first cover so people could realize it's a series. And the series is called the Heartland series. So when you look at cover one and cover two, you can see some resemblances. And so, you know, I've already got the idea for cover three using the same kind of theme, just change some figures on there. So when you read the first book, it's called, you know, Enemy in the Heartland, Where You Least Expect It is the subtitle. Well, the second book is called Revenge Unleashed, When You Least Expect It. Because the people who test read the second book said it's even better than the first book, because my wife tricked me one day, or I shouldn't say she tricked me. One in the afternoon, about this time of day, I'd been in my room for about 9 hours, and she came up with a glass of wine because the doctor said I can't drink beer anymore. Just drink as much red wine as you want to. She came in one afternoon about 4:30. She goes, you know, time for you to quit. Here's your glass of wine. You know, close it up. And she saw that I had a tear in my eye. She said, why are you crying? I said, well, one of the guys in the book, and one of the, you know, good guys, one of the main characters, I just killed him off. She said, what? And I said, yeah. And I said, it's kind of funny, but it was kind of emotional, you know, when I said, he's dead, you know. And I actually did have a tear in my eye. And I'm not an emotional guy, so it was kind of a weird feeling, probably because of the stroke. And she said something very prolific to me. She says, well, don't kill everybody off. You need a sequel. That's how the second book started. So, you know, I was about, you know, I would say 15% from the end of the first book, so I had plenty of time to, you know, plant the seed that something else might happen down the road. So,
do you intend to keep taking this beyond book three?
Yeah, I do. I'm not sure what the subject matter is going to be in regards to, you know, something going on somewhere in the world. But what I try to do is, you know, when I think about the book, I just write down what I see on TV. You know, right, you know, a couple of years ago it was drone, drone, drones, and now they're trying to get you to, you know, register. It's kind of like registering guns. Only the bad guys will have the guns, and they don't care about registering. So I think the drone effort to register is going to be just as goofy as gun laws. But, you know, when you think about it, you know, the drone's kind of lost its dramatic phase on the news. You know, it's kind of like becoming an old hat. But what do you see more and more now, especially all over in Europe, because of the crisis in the Middle East now? Homegrown terrorism. So I'm going, oh, homegrown. You know, you got the guys that blew up some people there during the Boston Marathon, and all these crazy kids walking into college campuses with guns and everything. So that's where I got the homegrown terrorist idea for the third book.
I see. Well, have you thought about crossing genres at all, or are you pretty much sold on the genre you're in?
No, there originally, when I first started thinking about books, they were sci-fi. And I moved from Albuquerque back to Phoenix one time, and I lost my outline, but I did do an outline for a series of sci-fi books. And they were kind of like the Star Wars, the Dark Force, strong. It was kind of like a Star Wars book. But it was a series that I was going to write, and I probably will do that one. It's a series about, aliens, all over the different galaxies, because there's got to be intelligent life. I refuse to believe we're the only intelligent people in the world or the universe. So, the way I did the outline for the book was the good guys in the galaxies, they were losing to the bad forces. So what they did was they went around to all the small little galaxies, way out in the boonies, and they spread some genetic seed, hoping to, generate a race of beings that were highly intelligent that could stand up to the evil forces. And so one day, many, many, many years later, millions of years later, a drone was found at the edge of our solar system, and it was a drone from the bad guys going, oh, we found one of the seedlings. Let's go check these guys out. And so that's the basis for the first book of the sci-fi series. So, it's kind of like a Star Wars, but it's not. It's kind of like a First Contact book, but it's not. So, that one would be lots of fun because I can have, there's one thing I really like, author's prerogative. I could take a lot of leeway with that.
Oh, yeah. Well, it sounds like you've got a very active imagination, too. And, boy, do you need that when you're writing a book.
Well, it's amazing, when you write things down in your outline, things you should put in there. Sometimes I'll look at those notes and I go, geez, what the hell's that about? I forgot about that. Or, that was really good. Maybe I'll do this. So, you're always kind of constantly tweaking the book. It's not a solid piece of metal going through from the beginning to finish. It's very fluid. And as you write, you get more and more ideas, and you got to kind of be selective on the ideas, and you got to kind of steer yourself through all your ideas, and that's the challenge.
Well, what was the editorial process like for you?
It was kind of nerving, and the reason why I say that is when Ken and I agreed to work together so he would edit the book. I gave him the email copy, or excuse me, the electronic copy of the book. And when I first started to get it back, I'm going, this is kind of unsettling. And my wife was going, wait a minute. So, well, that's my baby, and he's going to go in there and dissect my baby. He'll make it bigger, faster, and better. But it's like he's going to, start reading this, and he's going to get into my mind to think, I know who Steve Swartley really is. And it was kind of unnerving it for a while. But he's really been really a great guy. I mean, he's done great things with the original manuscript. And he's taught me how to write, believe it or not. So
how's that?
When you sit there and write, and I'm not a literary person, even though I wrote a book, I would use certain words wrong. Like when you walk past a water cooler, how do you spell past?
You're asking me, huh?
Yeah, I'm asking you.
Well, I think that probably this is a trick question. And I would imagine that instead of walking past the water cooler as in P-A-S-T, that you would describe a scenario that would make the water cooler a little bit more interesting.
No.
Okay.
I would write past, but past means past in history. I was supposed to write P-A-S-S-E-D.
Ah. Well,
so you see what I'm saying? So and another thing that will get you in trouble, believe it or not, is spell check. Because you put the wrong word in there and spell it correctly, it doesn't know that it's the wrong word. It just says it's spelled correctly. So, airplane hang, I had an E-R, G-E-R, instead of G-A-R. I mean, so there was all, at least I was consistent when I did mistakes. Every once in a while, there'd be kind of a goofy one. But the use of words, like which or that, I was using those too many times. And mm-hmm. getting the sequence of a sentence correct, because being a salesman, I talk too much. And so my sentencing would be kind of wordy at times. So, what I do nowadays, especially with the second book and now with the third book, on page 30 on the third book, is, when I get done writing, I'm tired at the end of the day. I mean, it feels like my brain just, was de-energized. Somebody pulled the battery out of my head. So the next day what I do is I go back and rewrite those, one or two or three pages, and just to see if I make sense. And I probably will spend an hour just tweaking what I wrote. And now that I've done a second editor, I try to do a better job at tweaking, if you know what I mean. So, and it's a good way of getting back in the story. But sometimes if I'm not going to touch the book for 3 or 4 days when I come back, it's really hard to come back because you get into a rhythm. And sometimes if you take 3 or 4 days off, it's hard to get back in that rhythm and going, what the hell was I thinking? Where was I going to go with this? So, I mean, I think everybody's probably, a little bit similar and a little bit different in the way they write. So, everybody's got their own little pitfalls, but it is an experience, a humbling experience.
Well, you talked about taking off 3 or 4 days and what a difference that makes, but what's your general writing schedule like? Do you find it's important to write every day?
Well, I try to treat it as a job, and I have the luxury to do that because, I'm retired now, so there's nothing else to do except for walk the dogs around the block or go wash a car. And you can only play so much golf. And after a stroke, my golf swing has kind of been decimated a little bit. But anyways, but I try to do it as a 6 to 8, sometimes 10-hour day schedule where I'll sit here and when I get into it, I'll forget about lunch. I'll look down at my watch and go, oh, shit, it's 2 o'clock or 2:30. So there are good days where you're really into it, and then sometimes there's a morning where you're going, you're not sure where to start typing. It does happen to me too, that's why I have my little outline, because, when I get stuck, I'll just start breezing through my outline going, okay, this is where I want to go and stuff. And occasionally, I'll be driving down the highway and I'll be listening to some talk show and I keep a little tablet on my console because they'll mention something about something. I'm going, oh, God, I got to put that in the book. That's really relevant, or that's really, current, or, people can relate to that. So I listen to, people and get the ideas all the time because it's like my characters in the book. When I have a bad guy, when he's a bad guy, I think about my old business partners or friends or college buddies or whatever, or people I've met at parties or whatever, and going, that guy would make a really good bad guy. So I would just describe the person, that I knew into the book. I wouldn't have to make it up. I would just describe people I know. So nowadays, I get people, that I talk to, like on talk shows or whatever, but, hey, I want to be in your book. Okay, next question I'll ask them then is, you want to be a good guy or a bad guy? Oh, I want to be a bad guy. I want to be a good guy. It's kind of funny. So when I start batting characters in the book, I'll send them an email, a day later or a couple weeks later going, hey, you're a policeman or you're a bomber pilot or you're this or that. And they're going, yeah. And so, because everybody wants to, everybody likes to be talked about. So,
sure. Well, you know, it's said that most, you know, writers write what they know. And, you know, that has to translate into people, too. And, of course, there are disclaimers at the beginning of every book. If it's a book of fiction, that's not based on any reality. But where do you come up with the storyline if you can't borrow from your real life?
That's right. You know, so, and put it this way, I couldn't have written the first or second book or the third book now if I didn't have the access to Google or Google Earth so I could do some research. I'd be stalled out a long time ago. I mean, I couldn't write this book 20 years ago without a computer or the internet.
Right, right. It makes all the difference in the world to be able to go through and do your edits and that kind of thing. When the edits were done in your book, was much of the book chopped out for you?
No, luckily, I think we might have changed. Well, the first book in Word documents, it was 357 pages, and it got chopped down to 347. Some of that was spacing and stuff, but I think I might have had to rewrite 2% of it, which I thought was pretty good. And the last book was maybe 1%. But, you know, so, you know, the outline is what keeps you centered, keeps you glued, keeps you on the highway. So I would highly recommend that to anybody.
Well, in the couple of minutes that are remaining, what advice would you give to an aspiring writer? What would be your best advice to them?
It depends on what they're writing, you know, a love story or, you know, to me, fiction is more fun than being something, you know, factual. Fiction, you can play, and the difference between a writer and an author is an author makes stuff up, and I'm really good at making stuff up. So, you know, if you're going to be an author, make stuff up, but choose something that people are familiar with or something that's trending. Because if you have to explain it to somebody, they're going to get bored in the first chapter. Even though my book's got so many characters, if you got to make it through the first two or three chapters and then you're hooked. But, you know, find something that's trending that you have a passion for and go for it. But if people don't have a clue what you're talking about when you first read the first two or three pages, you're not going to get a reader. And, you know, besides having a great cover, I think you need a good, prologue, you know, some type of 7 or 8 paragraph, you know, intro to the book so that it's juicy enough where it's going to hook the curiosity of the reader. You know, the prologue or at least the back cover blurb.
Well, thank you, Steve, and thanks for joining me tonight.
It's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure.
Wait. What's that?
I said it's been a pleasure.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with your books, and good luck with book number 3, and I hope that your social network marketing works out for you so that you have a bestseller on your hands.
Well, thank you, sir, and when the second one comes out, I'll give you a shout. We'll talk again.
Sounds good. All right, so once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience, having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks. To find common ground and take it to the next level, here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark, every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.